We'll have local news at 5. You don't want to miss that either. Stay tuned.
When every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
The KABU Community Radio Artists in Residence Program application period is open. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KABU mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artists in Residence Program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. Applications for the KABU 2017 Artists in Residence are due Friday, April 7th. More information can be found at kabu.fm/kabuair2017.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of A Night with Steve Early, Monday, March 20th at the Portland State University Bookstore in Portland. Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, will speak and discuss his book, which chronicles the 15 years of successful community organizing to create the progressive transformation of Richmond, California. Again, that's A Night with Steve Early, Monday, March 20th at the Portland State University Bookstore at 1715 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01 a.m. Coming up next,
he's 5 foot two, and he
is Veterans Voice. At 10, Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Lines Radio, we present a 40-year history of radical activism and the useful lessons for today's Trump resistance movements. At 11:30, Making Contact looks at reclaiming public schools, major changes in state curriculum, and where schools nationwide may be headed under Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. And thanks, KABU members, for your continued generous support. For those of you not yet members of the KABU Foundation, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. You click on the word donate. That's all coming up, so stay tuned.
Now masters of war, you feel all the big gun. I just want you to know I can see through your man. You never done nothing but build to destroy. Play with my world like you're the toy. How much do I know to talk out of turn? You may say that I'm young. You may say that I'm unlearned. But that one thing I know, you're younger than you.
sugar. Brothers to find. Then you sit back and watch while death cows get high. You sit in your mansion while young people's blood blow out of their bodies, buried in the mud. Let me ask you one question.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 104.3 Corvallis, 91.9 FM Hood River, and you can also listen to KBOO on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm. And if you want to listen to some of our older shows, you can go to kboo.fm / Veterans Voice. And also, Angie has us on Facebook, and you just put in Veterans Voice Radio Show, and it'll come up, and you can see some of the great stuff she puts on it. I'm Marvin, and I'm here with Angie.
Good morning, Cascadia.
She's got a cold, so she's coughing and hacking a little bit, but she's still doing okay. And last month we talked with Jonathan Huttu about his book Anti-War Soldiers, and we never really got through all of the questions that Angie wanted to ask and I wanted to ask about him. And this is we're having him back on today because his book is really, really interesting. He has a lot of really good things in it. And this is the first time in 27 years that we've ever had the same guest two times in a row. Hmm. And I think it's important that we get through.
Maybe we should tell him that.
Yeah. And we're going to talk to Jonathan. And Angie, got any announcements? I left my computer and my songs, everything at home this morning when I got up to come in, and I don't have anything like that. But if anybody's got anything they want us to talk about, they can call in to KBOO, and they'll take it down, and we'll announce it on the air.
Well, one of the things that we were wanting to do was a show about LGBTQ mm-hmm. veterans. Right. Or people who have been in the military that identify as LGBT, and we're looking to do a show on that particular subject. So if you know somebody who is LGBTQ and was in the military, we would love to hear your story.
Yeah, just contact us through KBOO.fm's webpage, and they'll get a hold of us, and we would really be interested in doing that. And we're also in the near future, we're going to have a show about Shoshana Johnson. And Shoshana Johnson was a single mother in the first Gulf War. What the Gulf War has never ended, it's a continual war. And she was captured and held prisoner and wounded and held prisoner at the same time that Jessica Lynch was. And everybody heard everything about Jessica Lynch, but they never really heard anything about Shoshana Johnson. And I saw a picture of her in a magazine that I was looking through, and I thought, geez, I had forgotten about it, you know? And so I've ordered two books. She's written a book called I'm Still Standing. And we're going to, I bought two books, one for Angie and one for me. And we're going to get a hold of her and have her come on the show and to talk about her book and how her life's going since all of this happened to her. And we're also going to get a hold of Don Luce. Don Luce went to Vietnam in 1958, and he was a civilian aid worker in Vietnam. And he turned against him when he got there, like the rest of them. He turned against the war as soon as the United States started building up troops, and they saw everything that was happening to the Vietnamese, and he just turned against the war, and he wrote a book along with another man, I can't remember his name, a book's called Vietnam, The Unheard Voices, and he's also the one. He's the man who took the U.S. senators and congressmen up to Con Son Island, which was a prison that the South Vietnamese had, and they had tiger cages, where these little cages where they would just put all the political prisoners in, and it was just such a horrible thing. And Don Luce is the man that did that, took them there and showed them that. And right after that, he got kicked out of the country. So we're going to be talking, we're going to get a hold of him. And that will be a really good show because, not very many people knows what was happening in Vietnam before the American troops got there. And Don was there, so he'll be able to tell us about it. And so, Angie, anything else you want to say before we get going?
Well, I just wanted to remind everybody, if you haven't heard about this, that Donald Trump gave the CIA power to carry out its own drone strikes. So if you didn't know that, then you should know that this is actually something that is pretty terrible, because the CIA does not have to disclose that at all. And so that is just one thing more that we need to keep looking at.
Yeah, they don't have. Obama had stopped them, and the military was doing drone strikes, but Trump has let them do it. And like Andrew said, they don't have to report how many strikes they made, and they do not have to report civilian casualties. And like Angie said, that's really a big problem. You know, he's raising the military budget by $54 billion. And to make up for that $54 billion, he's just slicing everything. He's taking so much money out of all these, you know, safety net programs that's keeping this country going. And he's also taking it out of foreign aid and all of this. And he doesn't understand what all that means, you know. And it's just such a horrible thing that he doesn't understand what's going to happen when he starts doing all that. And he can say all he wants. He can have this big, huge budget cuts that he wants, but it's up to the Congress. They're the ones that sign off on that. They're the ones that sign the checks. And if we got to put as much pressure on Congress, you know, to not let those cuts go through, because national education, national health, even the program for Meals on Wheels will be cut. Medicaid for people who need, or people who don't have very much money and need health care, that's going to be cut. And so this whole mess that he's doing, we need to really, really keep up on it and really put pressure on our senators and our congresspeople and try to get this thing slowed down or stopped, basically stopped. So, like Angie said, those drone strikes are they're a real problem. And you want to go ahead and introduce Jonathan?
Yeah. Do we have Jonathan here today?
Yeah. Great. Jonathan, welcome back to Veterans Voice.
Hey, thank you all for having me on.
Oh, no, it's our pleasure. Last month we didn't have enough time. Angie had a bunch of questions she wanted to ask you, and I had more questions that I wanted to ask you. And we want to talk to you today about, let's start out with the Marines mess with all these pictures. Have you been looking into that?
Well, I definitely have been kept abreast of it based on the same reporting you all are looking at, and it just goes to sadly and shamefully reconfirm, revalidate the type of culture the military is.
Right.
That women and men have to live within. I certainly was exposed to it when I was in the Navy, and actually sadly was witness to acts of sexism and misogyny. So, and then of course with the commander in chief that we have now, it definitely emboldens that culture. It makes it even harder. I mean, chain of command has never been a chain that's reliable, one that people who are marginalized due to race or sex, gender, what have you, the chain of command has never been reliable as a defender of human rights, human dignity. But now that we have this commander in chief here in Washington, it's sadly that culture of harassment and brutality is now in both.
Yeah, you're right there, Jonathan.
Well, I remember one of the things that you said in your book, excuse my crackly voice, one of the things that you said in your book when you went to the chaplain, you noticed that even the chaplain doesn't answer to any religious person, they answer to the chain of command too. So a lot of people wonder why people who are in the military and they experience some type of harassment, whether it be sexual or racist or anything, and why don't they just go to the chaplain? Well, the chaplain isn't really there to help you either, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, because when you in your book, on one of the chapters, it's on sexism, and this was really interesting to me, Jonathan. When I was reading your book, you talked about over 160,000 women have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and during the Vietnam War, they're saying 7,500 served in Vietnam, and 41,000 have served in the first Gulf War by itself. And I was in during Vietnam, and the only nurses that I remember, I mean, the only women I remember were nurses in Vietnam. That was it. But you know, you talk a lot about this in your book about the sexism on it. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's like Angie said, that when you went to see the chaplain, you know, the chaplain's no help for these women.
Right, right. When you know, when we filed our equal opportunity complaint in January of 2006, this was in response to the news incident. There was a full-blown equal opportunity investigation that took place in the shop where I work. This is the mass communication media division within the USS Theodore Roosevelt at that time. There was a lot of harassment that came to the fore, and one of the acts that took place, one of the harassment acts that took place was a young lady in our command who, now, again, we're working in a media shop, so people have access to Photoshop and things like that. What these guys were doing, some of these guys, I don't want to say all, but it was a small group of them, they would get on Photoshop and actually Photoshop pictures of this particular young lady performing acts of fellatio, what have you, and then posting them. And they had like a wall in the back of the Photoshop where they posted a lot of this garbage. Hmm. The chain of command saw it, said nothing about it. And the young lady definitely took her complaints to the chain. They did nothing about it. But once that equal opportunity complaint, once it became a full-blown investigation, I had to make the distinction between making a complaint and then the investigation starting. It's very rare that an investigation actually takes place. You can file a complaint, nothing happens. But in this particular situation, the investigation did take place. And that young lady had a full hearing, not just with the equal opportunity investigator, but actually went before the executive officer and the captain of the ship, which is very rare as well, because 9 times out of 10 those complaints get swept underboard. But there were other situations. Alleged groping. Mm-hmm. Which I use the word alleged just from a legalistic standpoint. You and I both know that the groping happens. It takes place in the Navy. They call it grab assing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the chain of command is, 9 times out of 10 culpable and just as guilty, because they sweep it under the rug. What they teach you in the military, what they try to train you in the military on, is handling everything at the lowest level possible,
right,
and utilizing your chain of command. But in reality, what that does is it gives the chain of command the opportunity to really sweep everything under the rug and to ensure that whatever is taking place never rises to the fore, ever gets challenged.
Right.
If you're going to fight, you got to figure out a way to not only take on the individual perpetrators, but you got to actually take on your chain of command that protects them. It's a hard act.
Yeah, because I was reading your book on that and talking with Angie, because Angie knows about this, and when these women come to their chain of command and they don't get anything done about it, I mean, they get swept under the rug, that's got to be so disheartening that nothing's done with it. It just seems to make them a second class a service person in the military, And I was been reading up on this the Marine Corps and all this picture stuff that they have on what they say, Andy, something like 10,000 people on.
No. There were 30,000 people. And there was another site that was linked to it.
Mm-hmm. And so these women, Jonathan, I mean, if they don't have any help through the EEOC, Angie, is that what it is?
Equal opportunity.
Yeah, and in the military, what chance do they have, Jonathan?
Well, not just none, but they can actually get in trouble. If you report something in the military, you get in trouble. And you can many times just consider yourself done with your job.
Really?
Pretty much.
Wow.
You usually will get demoted, maybe not actually in rank, but your status among your unit will basically go down. You're shunned.
Right.
You get punished.
Wow. Jonathan, in your book, you were saying that only 10% of all the cases result in a court-martial of the perpetrator, and half these cases are dismissed. Is that true still?
Yeah. I mean, I believe so. I don't have the current numbers. But whenever punishment actually takes place, like so in this case that has become national and even international now,
mm-hmm.
Whenever it hits that level, usually you will potentially get some punishments that happens to junior petty officers or junior officers. just to really pacify the situation. Mm-hmm. It's kind of you know, what happened with the My Lai massacre, for example, in Vietnam, and the whole, you know, Lieutenant Calley situation. You know, that's actually the example. That's the prototype, if you will, of how the military deals when something becomes a scandal. You ensure that you punish a low-level person in order to protect the people who actually were the design makers and the real perpetrators of the situation. In the 1980s, that would have been, you know, Oliver North, for example, and the whole Iran-Contra scandal, as if some colonel was the whole instigator of the situation, you know. So, and we all know that wasn't the case. And so in my own situation that I wrote about there, within my book, in terms of that equal opportunity investigation, the ship felt they had to rise and do something because of the way in which I handled it. Because we wrote our letter, when we actually sent our letter, we sent it to the entire chain of command. Wow. And it became pretty clear that if they weren't going to do something about the situation, that we were prepared to go off the ship.
Yeah.
And I think that, and because we were off the coast of Iraq with 2 months left to go, in the midst of bombing that country with this racist, xenophobic, sexist situation going on in the shop, then the Navy has to figure out a way to save face, you know, in that type of situation. So as an activist and as an organizer, you have to figure out a way to sharpen those contradictions. And I think that, and this is really the hard part. I don't want to be too long, but the real hard part is that when that individual act of aggression happens to that sailor, that soldier, that Marine, the hardest thing is to get that person to take that situation beyond themselves individually and to politicize it. You know, because if you look at it from just an individual standpoint, sometimes it's much easier to just suck it up and keep moving on.
Right.
Than to actually politicize it and deal with it in such a way where it impacts everyone in your shop and the entire command. And that's a tall order. Most people would not do that because of the risk, as Angie talked about, the risk that's involved. And some people just don't want to deal with emotions. And let's just face it, some people would rather deal with certain acts of oppression in order to be accepted among the peers.
Mm-hmm. Did, Angie can maybe answer this, and you too, but do, when the women are sexually assaulted or raped or are just abused, don't your comrades step up and try to help you? Help, Angie?
No. No.
Wow.
Never.
Wow. Jonathan, does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. In fact, I would take it even further. I would say that in order to, at least when I was in the Navy, and I've been out 5.5 years now, I don't think it's changed that much.
But yeah.
Years, but
I don't think it's changed.
Yeah, not only will your chain of command not step up for you, but the women within the chain of command actually buy into the sexist, misogynist culture as well.
Wow.
When I say those women, let me be specific. Women who are lifers.
Lifers?
Those who have chosen to not only make the military career, but want to rise within that chain of command to become senior enlisted officers, what have you. In order to do that, then you become a defender.
Right.
You become a defender of the culture. So you will see women in the Navy, they call they call long term people bubbles. Everybody's a bubble. Well, then the women start calling themselves bubbles.
Really?
It's a weird culture. Yes, it is.
Yeah. And with so many women being in the military now, I wonder what the reenlistment rate. It can't be very high for women with all the harassment and everything. Like I was listening to this a veteran. She was talking about how she wasn't, well, it wasn't her, she was already out, but they talked to an active duty woman, and when she found out about this, she said she would not going to reenlist. And she said that, did you hear her, Angie? Did you hear her? Yeah, and she said she was not going to reenlist. And that whole story was on NPR that I heard, which is good, like you were saying, Jonathan, that it's got to be politicized. And for the whole, you know, the whole country to hear what's happening to these women in the military. And at 30,000 people on that 30,000 people on the on that Facebook page, and not one of them brought it up about what was happening to these women. That's just horrible. And I think that we want to move on a little bit. And I know that sexism is a real problem in the military, but Angie and I want to talk about, in your book, you call it a failed policy, and that's don't ask, don't tell. And that went into effect, what, 2007? Don't ask, don't tell policy. Can you talk a little bit about that, Jonathan? That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, right now we're not under the don't ask, don't tell policy anymore.
Right.
Now we're in a situation where gays and lesbians can serve openly in the military. And I say gays and lesbians because I'm not sure actually about bisexual, transgender, and queer.
Mm-hmm.
I think the line is drawn there, if I'm mistaken. But I do believe lesbians and gays can serve openly.
Yeah, they can serve openly. But Angie, go. She brought this up that that don't ask, don't tell was a failed policy, because if somebody was serving in the military and they were gay, and if somebody brought it up to the chain of command, they could still be kicked out. Did that happen on your ship? Did you know anybody on your ship that were gay or lesbian that was serving that was open?
It was very, yeah, yes, I do. And,
oh, good.
And the chain of command knew about it as well. I mean, there was definitely folks in our command who were gay and lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in my last command, there was a transgender in my last command, yes. So this was, but it was in that kind of situation. But chain of command, from my experience, did not move on these people.
Good.
For the most part, because these people were integral to the daily operation of the command of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
One of the major driving force, from where I sit, is an economic driving force.
Go ahead.
So as long as now I'm speaking anecdotally. I'm not talking in terms of the actual numbers across the military, but just from my experience, if they didn't have to move on you, they wouldn't. But the reason why I call it a failed policy is because even though the chain would not move on you, at the same time, you have to hide who you are.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you have to live in silence. You have to live in some silo.
Ugh.
You can't be open about who you are and what you are, which is disgraceful.
Oh, just really disgraceful.
Yeah, it's just disgraceful. So that's essentially what I called it, a failed policy. And in fact, that's exactly it. It definitely was a failed policy because the military changed it. And ironically, if that's the right term to use, that was the policy that General Colin Powell said forced him out of the leadership of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. If you recall, when Bill Clinton got elected in 1992, his campaign promise was to lift the ban on gays and lesbians in the military. Don't ask, don't tell became the compromise policy between him and General Colin Powell, because Chairman Powell opposed lifting the ban on gays and lesbians. He used language like it would lead to the breakdown in military decorum and morale or whatnot. And it's amazing to me the amount of people who call themselves progressive, even liberals, who when they talk about Colin Powell, they give him a pass on everything. Mm. But if you analyze Colin Powell's history, dating back to the My Lai massacre, when he was one of the officers involved in that command that carried out that massacre, he was a defender of the My Lai massacre. He was a national security advisor to Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. We're talking about Grenada, Nicaragua, Libya, Honduras, all of those military interventions that caused toppling of government. Colin Powell advising Reagan. Colin Powell was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs that advised George Bush in the first Iraq War. Colin Powell was the Secretary of State for the second Bush. Colin Powell was one that went to the United Nations and sold the plan to the world to invade Iraq. And yet, when people talk about Colin Powell, they talk about him as a progressive and a liberal. So it really shows what we're up against. As people that struggle to be genuine about our work and what we do.
sorry, excuse me.
She's having a little trouble here. Alan Schindler was viciously beaten to death by some of his shipmates that the public at large realized the potential horrors of being LGBT. And he was, and that was before, I think, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was brought in.
That was why it got lifted. So I wanted to bring up that point and maybe have you comment on that.
Yeah.
It was only after a horrific attack like that. I wanted to mention his name, Alan Schindler. Can you talk about who that was?
Yeah,
and
Alan Schindler.
The significance of that?
You know, the case I'm thinking about is Alan Shepard.
Alan
Shepard was not in the military, was he?
No, Shepard wasn't in the military, but Schindler was. And I think I want to bring up another one that when Angie brought this up was about the soldier in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. That he was a gay soldier, and I think this was before Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I'm thinking, where he was beaten to death by guys in his own platoon. They beat him to death because he was a gay man. And that's probably, you know, Jonathan, a lot of people don't know, we did a show kind of on this, that more men in the military are raped than women.
Yeah, I didn't know that either, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah, more men are raped in the military than women are raped, and they never really brought that. You know, it's never really been brought out to the public that all these people have been raped. We're gonna, Jonathan, open up the phone lines here for if somebody has a question or they want to talk about something that happened to them in the service. So if you're a veteran and you were in the service and you were LGBTQ or if you were harassed, a woman that was harassed in the military, you can give us a call at 503-231-8187, and we only have about 20 minutes, but if someone wants to ask Jonathan a question, we'll go with that. And I want to go back to the gays in the military, and people don't understand the gays have been in the military since there's been militaries, you know, and in some countries gays have been able to serve open. Like I think the Netherlands, the folks can serve in the open. In Vietnam, we knew of guys in our company that were gay, and nobody cared. You know, nobody cared about that they were gay at all. But, you know, they never brought it up. You know, we never told our platoon leader or anybody that our brother was gay, because they would have been kicked out. But there's always been gays in the military. And but for them to be killed, to be beaten and killed because of their sexuality is just unbelievable. Just unbelievable. We want to talk about your feelings on Trump, about what's going on with Trump and you know, his whole thing here, Jonathan. What do you you know, he's going to raise the military budget by $54 billion. What's your feelings on what's going on with Trump in our country?
Well, I affirm what Ralph Nader said about it recently on Democracy Now!, and that is that if you didn't think the mask was off, well, the mask is off now. The fangs are out.
Yeah,
Trump is definitely not masking who he is to the American working class.
Mm-hmm.
And that it has to be a full frontal attack, if you will, from the working class to these folks in Congress. It's good to see the amount of people that are turning out at these town hall meetings across the country, both to the Congress folks and the senators, because 2018 is next year, and we got to be sure that we gear our people up to change the direction and the course of where the country is now. But no, I think Donald Trump, I mean, look here. I mean, Donald Trump is... he's certainly the greatest, if that's the right term to use, threat that we've had to our humanity from the executive branch of government, definitely in my lifetime, and I would even say in the last probably 50 to 100 years. But if I look at the U.S. presidency, the analyzer, Donald Trump would have to probably be the greatest threat to our humanity. I'm really thinking about this because probably since Herbert Hoover, maybe,
yeah.
I mean, this is definitely someone who has very, very not just fascist tendencies, but has a fascist mindset, and it seems like the only thing, the only entity or barrier that is keeping him from going where he wants to go is the courts, you know, because we do have this principle of a divided government, a balanced government, checks and balances from the judiciary, legislative, executive branches, and so the judicial branch is serving as the last barrier because the legislative branch has totally surrendered because they're under the control of the Republican Party.
Right.
They're going to turn a blind eye. We know that the executive branch is, so the judiciary is the last really halt on where Trump wants to go. And so I think that for those people, you know, who have these, you know, those of us on the left, if I can use that term, when I say the left, I mean left of the Democratic Party.
There you go.
Who have, you know, these debates every 2 years about whether or not to vote, should we vote? I hope Trump drives home the point that we can debate whether or not we're Democrat. We can debate whether or not we deal Democratic Party. I don't think we debate whether or not we vote. Voting, and I'd be the first to say that voting should not be seen as politics. I think that's a problem when people see voting as politics. But voting is certainly an extension of our political toolkit. It certainly is a tool that we have to use in our work in order to get some humanity and some semblance of justice. And so, you know, the people have the power in the next 2 years, specifically and certainly in the next 4 years, to change the course. And so it's dialectical. On one end, the people are catching hell right now, but on the other end, people have the power to register to vote and change the course. And then we got to push for some reform, just like the progressive movement did a century ago. I mean, our generation don't remember this. There was a time when United States senators were appointed in this country.
Right.
They weren't voted directly by the people. that change came about due to the progressive populist movement in this country 100 plus years ago. So now we're at this point again where we need to really examine and look at the Electoral College. It is a remnant of a past in this country that does not is not suitable nor feasible for the current electorate that we have.
So, right.
Again, the time is now. Time is now.
Yeah, because you know you brought up the Electoral College, and that's really a problem, but. The Electoral College has elected two of the worst presidents in my generation, and in my time was George W. Bush and Donald Trump. And what happened with Donald Trump, he lost the popular vote by 3 million people. 3 million votes, and he only won the Electoral College by 77 votes. So 77 votes has put us in this mess we're in. And George W. Bush lost the popular vote. I can't remember how many that he lost by, but he only won the Electoral College by 3 or 4 or 5 votes. And look at the damage that he did to this country. The damage he did, you know, and by him attacking Iraq just opened up this whole mess that we're going through now. By him attacking Iraq. And the Electoral College, like you said, is a remnant of a very racist, you know, decision that was put into the Constitution. Is it in the Constitution? Yeah, it's in the Constitution. That was put into the Constitution that has, you know, and like you say, in today's age, there's no reason for it to be there. When 77 votes can decide what a nation's going to do, and when that person that was elected on those 77 votes is somebody like Donald Trump or George W. Bush, we've got a real problem. And I'm glad you brought that up. I'm really glad you brought that up. So what do you think is some of the other things that we should work on? You know, why this guy's, you know, at the realm of power in the world. I mean, he's meeting today, Jonathan, with Angela Merkel, and he badmouthed her. Remember how bad he badmouthed her, you know, when he was running for president? I can imagine, you know, what he's going to talk about with her. What do we got to watch out for? What do we have to do?
Well, I think first and foremost, we have to organize, mm-hmm. and we have to organize at the local level. And organize at the local level connected to the state and the national in order to build some alternative power. We have to organize. We have to organize and build some structure and some organizations on the ground that are outside of the two-party system. Because to what was happening in the last, especially since the post-civil rights Vietnam era, is that the movement is dominated by and large by NGOs on the ground. And so you got this sort of professionalization of the human rights movement in such a way where common men and women don't even know how to enter into it. And so those of us who have the skill set, the passion, and either have the time or going to carve out some time, we've got to create some alternative bases on the ground for men and women to come around and to organize and to fight. You know,
right.
We have to do it outside of the electoral sphere, although connected to the electoral sphere. It's an interesting kind of dialectic. Like, okay, so in other words, we can't be controlled by the Democratic Party. Looking at that situation that took place a couple of weeks ago between the election of Tom Perez and Keith Ellison, they'll present that in the media like that's something that has to do with the people. But in actuality, that's an election among elites. you know, everyone don't vote in that election. So we have to figure out a way to create alternative spaces for us to struggle around these issues, issues around fracking, issues around police brutality, issues around ICE and these mass detentions, and deportations that are taking place.
Right.
We have the power at the local level to do in 2017 what our folks were doing 150 plus years ago, during the when they passed the fugitive slave law,
right,
and federal agents chasing enslaved African slaves running, getting out of enslaved situations. We have to provide that level of refuge and that level of backup right now and put our bodies on the line. So
there
that's
you
what
go.
We have to do right now. That's the situation and the moment that we're in.
Yeah, I think you're right. We got a call from Francis that Francis, go ahead.
Hi, I just am appreciating your conversation this morning. One thing, are you guys aware of the bombing that took place in Syria yesterday?
No.
The American bombing.
No. What happened?
They bombed. Allegedly, they were targeting an Al-Qaeda site, but it ended up hitting a mosque and killing over 60 people, and a whole bunch of people were injured, and the mosque was destroyed.
Oh.
And that was in Syria. And they American forces, it was an airstrike.
Mm-hmm.
They acknowledged that they did do a strike, but they're not acknowledging that the mosque was the target, although it was during evening services, so it's pretty bad. But one thing I wanted to say is Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
She has a bill. I think it's been co-sponsored by that Rand Paul, but a Republican. But it's telling the legislation is to stop the regime change wars.
Mm-hmm.
And within it, she's saying that what they're doing is financing the so-called ISIS and terrorists with their regime change wars.
Oh, boy.
And to me, it's a very brave, they're calling her a maverick, but it's a very brave thing for her to do, because she's pretty much laying it out the way we've been talking, that, you know, if we would stop doing what we're doing, then we wouldn't have to worry about retaliation from quote-unquote terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish she would get more support. Probably it won't go very far because of the nature of the bill, but I'm happy that at least someone is seeing what's going on and acknowledging it and having the courage to address it.
Okay, thanks, Francis. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Jonathan, you brought that up in your book, where all these people were saying about, you know, we got to stop this, and then when they get back there, they vote for it. You know, they go ahead and vote for it, you know. So let's go. I want to go back to, we only have about three more minutes before we're going to have to cut it off. You're right, Jonathan, we have to organize, and you're right, we have to organize on the local level to really to get it started. And can you give us some more ideas before we have to go about what you think we should do, buddy?
Well, you know, I think, and when I say organize, let me be more specific. I think we have to bring together coalitions on the ground, because in actuality we have a good amount of organizations on the ground,
mm-hmm.
but not working in coalition with each other. And so here in Prince George's County, Maryland, where I live, we've built a Prince George's County People's Coalition that wants to bring together organizations on the ground. We have Unitarian churches involved. We have the Quakers, the Friends involved. We have Southern Christian Leadership Conference. You know, professors, students, members of the NAACP, bus riders, you know, a host of organizations, some who never interact with each other, or when they do, is more around mobilization or issues, and not necessarily organizing for power.
Right.
To bring a coalition of folks together to harness their energy, and to do so with those who we believe are the most genuine about this work, because unfortunately, in this period that we find ourselves, we do have opportunists who are attempting to harness the anger that we have and the grief that we have in order to fortify themselves. And so we want to ensure that when the smoke clears, that the people's agenda, particularly in our locales, is one that we can deal with at our school boards, at our county councils, our city council, and that we hold people accountable, those that we vote in, but that we also create an activist culture that says that we should vote, but we have to do more than vote. We got to go vote, and we also got to act, got to organize, got to sit in, lay in, put some pressure on folks, rally, and make it uncomfortable. And in fact, not just uncomfortable, but make it ungovernable. So that's where we are.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me. Jonathan, I really want to thank you for coming back on and letting us go through some of this stuff that Angie and I wanted to talk about. And Angie's sick, so she kept pointing stuff in the book for me to ask you. And Jonathan, thanks a lot, and I hope we hear from you soon, buddy.
Thanks again. Thank you for having me. Hope you feel better, Angie.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming back.
Yes, thank you. And I want to... Francis just called in and talked about, I hadn't heard about that, you know, and I listened to the news, and I hadn't heard that, and I'm glad she mentioned it. But that just, you know, gets right in there with the CIA, you know, doing their drone strikes. There's going to be a lot more of that we won't hear about. We won't hear about what happened. And Jonathan brings up a really important point, and that is the organizing. You know, I'm not sure, but a couple thousand war veterans went to Standing Rock, you know, and they were on the front lines in Standing Rock, and there's a whole bunch of us out there that feel the same way, that we need to, all of us folks, get together and really put up a united front of veterans movement against what's going on. You know, just because, you know, Trump said that he's going to take care of the veterans, you know, with more money to the VA and all that, you know, that's not, you know, good enough for me. I want that whole thing for everybody. I want everybody to be taken care of on this thing. We got to watch out what this guy does, you know. He's putting up all these screens, you know, doing all this, and then behind the screens is really, really going after us as a country. And we really need to work on that. We need to get organized. We need, like Jonathan said, and I hope you folks enjoyed the show. And like Angie and I said, we're going to have some more people on, a few, and really, really, really get a hold of us if you were in the military and you were harassed, or if you're LGBTQ, and we really, really want to do a show on that. So we'll be back on April the 21st at 9 a.m., and there it is. One day you're gonna die.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Golda's Balcony, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from March 10th through April 1st at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Golda's Balcony is the final work for Tony Award-winning playwright William Gibson. The play is a portrait of Golda Meir, an Israeli teacher, kibbutznik, stateswoman, and politician, and the fourth elected Prime Minister of Israel. Again, that's Golda's Balcony, March 10th through April 1st at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Gospel of Loving Kindness at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center in Portland. The Gospel of Loving Kindness is a play by Marcus Gardley based on the true story of 15-year-old Hadiya Pendleton, who was killed in Chicago after performing at the presidential inauguration in 2013. This play runs from March 10th through April 9th on Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. Again, that's The Gospel of Loving Kindness, March 10th through April 9th on Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, 5340 North Interstate in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right.